G'day. When last we left our heroes here on Microsoft Jumpstart, they were trying to deploy a website to Microsoft Azure. We've kicked those guys out, found ourselves a proper Australian. I, in fact, have got a sore throat, and I'm going to be basically speaking in a non-specific accent for the rest of the day. Damien Edwards, how are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you very much. How are you?
Galloway's on walkabout. What exactly happened when he tried to deploy to Azure?
Well, it looks like it is actually up. So people have hit the site and it seems to be working perfectly fine. In fact, some people have tried to even trick the system by using some SQL injection, but we can see that their name is now apostrophe and one equals one.
So people are putting in like alert pwned.
Select star from person and things like that. But it is actually working. It is up there now. You can see that the data is in there and you can add stuff there. So
what happened? Is it a concurrency thing?
Yeah, we think that people may have been hitting the site while John was trying to do the deployment. Mm-hmm. And while that happens, you can be having requests come in the middle of the deployment process, like taking down the old site and bringing the new site up, and that can cause the yellow screens like you saw.
And that's why you usually do a deployment in a rolling way.
Correct.
Deploy to one place, turn the one other off, switch over.
Absolutely, so you don't see those problems.
All right, cool. So go ahead and bring up our slides here. And we're now in module number 3.
Yep, creating HTML5 applications with jQuery.
Bring our slides up on the big screen there. So yeah, so we are right there. Creating HTML5. Let's talk a little bit about HTML5. The overview of the module is going to be general kind of understanding what exactly is HTML5. It's a little bit of an overloaded term. We'll do a little bit of hands-on work in HTML5 and see what it's like in Visual Studio, some of the new editor improvements for HTML5. We'll talk a little bit about jQuery, why we think jQuery is great, kind of why jQuery won when it comes to DOM selection, things like that.
Absolutely.
We'll dig into some of the web tools, look at Web Essentials. We talked a little bit about why Web Essentials is important and the relationship between the Web Essentials editions and Visual Studio itself. And then some of the new SPA, single page application templates that we added in Web Tools 2012.2.
SPA, as SPA. We would say in Australia.
You do say SPA?
SPA.
Fantastic. So, what is this HTML5? It's this umbrella term, and it's completely overloaded. But what HTML5, for me, is less about the markup, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
And more about the family of technologies.
Absolutely. So when I think of HTML5, I think of this sort of next evolution of the capabilities available in the web browser. I mean, traditionally, we think of the web browser as being fairly dumb. All it can do is send requests to the server, download some rudimentary level text, whether it's CSS, HTML, or a little bit of JavaScript. And then whenever you want to do something meaningful, again, you post it back to the server and you get another response. With HTML5, we now have the browser essentially becoming like an operating system or a VM. Like you have these modules available to you to do data access, to do real-time communication, to do sockets, even to do authentication, and really advanced layout. And these are all the subsystems you would find in a full-blown operating system. So now the client is actually a fully capable platform that you can send really rich applications to.
Exactly. Browsers have become so powerful that they are really an operating system. Storage APIs, threading APIs, and HTML5 itself is more than just some angle brackets for section and some angle brackets for header.
Right, exactly. It's not just about semantic markup. It's about entirely new subsets, new APIs that you can use to add amazing new capabilities to your application.
The part that's tricky, though, is that we get that, and the viewer gets that, but the viewer's boss doesn't seem to get that.
Right, right.
How do you explain HTML5 to a bot? They think it's some hard and fast version. But the web seems to be moving fast. I almost feel like HTML5 has had several iterations, and it's not even officially done yet.
Right. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people even just refer to it now as it's just HTML. I mean, from here on out, everything is HTML5. HTML5 was kind of the level set and said, you know, this thing is going to change from here on in forever. Let's just, every time we think of something new, it sort of gets moved under this umbrella of HTML5.
Exactly. Let's switch over to my machine and take a look at some crazy stuff that you can do with HTML5. So if I bring up a browser, and like every good Microsofty, I run, I use DuckDuckGo as my search engine. No, I'm just kidding. true story, I launched this up, and look at that. HTML5, it's crazy, the stuff that you can do.
Yeah.
One of the things that I like to show is this thing called Contre-Jour.
Oh, I love this game.
Now, let me load that again. I'm going to load it there. Look at that. So this was the iPad game of the year.
Right.
In 2011.
Yep.
This is HTML5. Here, let me bring. I'm going to turn on my volume here, just so you can kind of get a sense. Oh, it's being. I think it's being fed through the back end system, so you probably can't hear it. But this is all HTML5 here. This little man. Look at that. The particles. Look at the grass moving.
It almost looks like what we would have expected out of a Flash or Silverlight game a few years ago.
Exactly.
Really.
And the thing is that the gentleman that started this, Maxim is the author of this, when the IE team said, we want to do this, he said, I won't let it be done unless it can be perfect.
Right.
And he would go back and forth, and you know, this grass isn't moving right, and this physics experience, look at that, pick the little man up. You know, if it doesn't look perfect, then I won't let you do it. It's really, really crazy.
It's amazingly capable.
So that means that there's effectively a complete VM here. Not a VM like a Silverlight or like a JavaScript, but the browser itself is an OS that we can now target.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's what HTML5 kind of means to me. But HTML5 is more than just games and Flash, things like that. It's also the idea that websites can live in multiple contexts. You can have a single website that is mobile, that is on a tablet, that is on a 30-inch screen, and they can all behave differently.
Right.
If we take a look at like my blog, for example, I'm just going to resize here. This is a design that I hired a designer, and I encourage everyone to hire a designer to do stuff. Notice that I've got that right rail there, you see? And as I start resizing, that right rail disappears.
Oh, look at that. Yeah.
Right about there. Now you see that that orange text up at the top there.
Yeah. Ah, it's adapting as you're changing the side there, or responding as you make it.
Very nice softball.
Thank you.
Pitch there.
No, no one noticed that.
That was lovely. This DOM, the DOM here, the ULs and the LIs that appear in that unordered list.
Ah, they've been repurposed. Mm-hmm. Into a new UI that's appropriate
right.
for this size.
And this is just me as far as my opinion, but I personally prefer to use native controls whenever possible.
Yeah.
I realize people can do kind of what I call owner draw controls.
Right.
But what's nice about this is that if you visit my blog, and I encourage you all to visit my blog, on an Android or a Windows phone, you're going to get the drop-down that those phones use.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think we saw it first with the iPhone. You'd have a drop-down or select element in HTML would then be rendered using the native graphics stack inside the browser, and it would sort of slide up from the bottom, and it was appropriate for thumb use.
Right.
And now we have the equivalent in Android and Windows Phone and those type of things, as you said.
So. Exactly. Now, if I go and hit the ASP.NET website and then resize, it also has a responsive design. And you notice this menu here. This is kind of the universal sign for menu. There's an owner draw menu. And this works on an iPad or an iPhone. There's a website that I like to visit. It's called Media Queries. This is one of those websites that has kind of taken over Spain and their top-level domain in order to be hip, just like Flickr took over Korea with their flick.kr
right.
domain. Media Queries is an inspirational site full of examples of great websites and how they choose to express themselves at different sizes.
Oh, look at that.
It's really quite clever. Gives you ideas like, you see how this site here makes their map smaller and smaller, and then they remove the map for a phone.
So does this require a lot of JavaScript to do this type of thing? I mean, in the past, you could have probably achieved this by listening to resize events and doing a lot of relayout. Is it easier now?
That's a great question. Thank you. Fantastic question there, Damien. I appreciate that. Let's talk about it. This is almost like those 2 a.m.
Yes.
Placing tiny little ads out of my one-bedroom apartment into newspapers all over the country. I was able to move out of my mom's house, and now I live on a yacht in the Caribbean. Remember that guy? You ever had those guys in Australia?
We had those guys in Australia, except we would just watch the ones from other countries.
Yeah. They got those guys. They have them in every country.
They have them in every country. Yeah, absolutely.
There was one guy on, I think it was like Sábado Gigante, and he was like a psychic. And I don't really know what he was saying, but he was like, he would always wear like all the sequins.
In the world, all
like,
of them.
Like he had all the sequins, and it was like almost like a Marlon Brando. Imagine Marlon Brando with like a Pope hat and all the sequins. And I found it offensive because my uncle worked in the sequin mines, and he would wear this thing, and he would go, "Los telefónicas psíquicas completamente gratis para ti." Gratis para ti. On the phone, the psychics are waiting, ready for you. Call the psychics. And I was just like, he's so excited about what he's doing. And now 20 years later, I'm doing that for Microsoft.
Absolutely.
Todo lo del platform completamente gratis para ti. Este código es completamente punto net puro. ¿Sí?
What was I saying?
I think we're looking at CSS media queries.
I think my tea was spiked.
May have been. But your voice does sound good.
Well, yeah, I've been gargling.
Yeah.
One of our Twitter people was like, "You should gargle." I'm like, "All right, I'll gargle with tea." So this is, I think this is a standard website here. Do-do-do-do-do. Waiting for a local host. Okay. So this is the out-of-the-box what you get in ASP.NET, right? So if I take this, we've got the home about contact over there.
Ah.
These are called breakpoints. There's a moment there. It's probably 1,024. Now, notice those bullets on the left there. At some point, we declare them just not that useful.
Right, superfluous.
Superfluous, exactly. We get rid of them. So that's responsive design. Let's look at what that is in CSS. You asked if that was going to be an operation in JavaScript.
Right.
In fact, that's called a media query. So here, just within our CSS, we're saying, well, if we're only on the screen and our width is 850, so it looks like it's 850, not 1,024.
Yeah.
We're going to start changing stuff.
Right.
The most common and the easiest thing that you can do is just hide something.
Just turn stuff off.
Turn stuff off.
Right.
But there's an interesting kind of argument in the front-end design community right now. Do we design for big monitors and turn stuff off, or do we design for tiny screens and turn stuff on?
Right. And that's kind of the difference between the idea of graceful degradation and progressive enhancement. Do we start from something up here and then degrade gracefully to a lower bandwidth, smaller screen size? Or do
exactly.
we start with that and then enhance as we go up?
Exactly. Let's take a moment and switch back to the slides. Your slides. Your machine. So in the old days, there were tables, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was great because you could get a job if you knew how to do a row span.
Yes.
I mean, I knew guys who could become a senior engineer
yes.
based entirely on their call span versus row span.
And their ability to nest tables inside other tables,
I actually know that there was a limit in Netscape. I was in Netscape, not Firefox. Netscape 3 had a limit of 32 nested tables.
Oh, wow.
And the only way that you learn about limits like that is by hitting them.
Yes.
Yeah. So the browser world has become much more complicated now. It's more than just tables now. And the W3C and HTML5 kind of sits on top of this map of all of these different specifications. These are kind of scary. And you could look at that and say, this is more than I can handle.
That's a lot of text to have to go and read and figure out.
Right. And ultimately, right now, before HTML5, we would end up with these documents that were basically documents and then islands of active.
Right.
And this, you know, basically Java existed only to show physics demos.
In this case, the HTML was a delivery mechanism for something that wasn't HTML. That's all it was.
That's well said.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, and then, honestly, if you fast forward, that's what this was, wasn't
right.
it?
Right, absolutely.
I mean, how many divs were really in there? You know, we'd have to go and view source to see. But for us as application developers, this is the essence of HTML5 that we need to focus on, kind of the new semantic elements that really matter. Things like header, footer, section, these are kind of the obvious, and again, I hate to overuse the term, but the low-hanging fruit.
Right.
These are, all of our new templates are HTML5. So if I go over into index, for example, we're making sure that we've got sections and everything is nice and clean. ULLI, I mean, it's a pretty basic site. And if you look at any good site, you can find out whether or not it's well laid out and seeing if it's got, like, divitis.
Right, or classitis.
Classitis or
yeah.
divitis, exactly. That's about as deep as you want to get, 2 or 3 divs deep.
Yeah.
Anything more than that, and you may
And
get
there are
divitis.
Different reasons why this is important. I mean, we use this term semantic tag names or semantic element names. And semantic simply means that the tag name itself has meaning. I mean, a div has no meaning. It's
right.
literally an empty container type that you're supposed to use to represent whatever it is you want to represent.
Exactly.
But now we have a vocabulary. Now we can say, well, this isn't just a div. It's a section of my document, or it's the header of my document. And so while it's great for us as developers, we now have more structure that we can attach things like CSS and JavaScript to. We're not attaching to a class anymore. We're attaching to all sections or all H groups or all articles. It also has meaning. So things like a screen reader can actually glean more information about the document simply from the tags that you've read, or this idea of the semantic web. We have technologies that when they crawl your page or want to understand how your page is laid out, looking at a bunch of divs and classes doesn't tell anyone anything about what type of content it is, whereas obviously something like nav or menu tells you what's inside of that element.
Exactly. So if we look at this code here, in the old days of the web, which would have been December of last year,
right,
you would say something like div class equals header, and then maybe you'd have div class equals sidebar.
Right, exactly.
And then you'd go and attach meaning to that.
Yes. And that language was your own. I mean, every site used its own vocabulary to describe what was a header and what was a sidebar.
Exactly. And whether you can tell whether or not you work at an enterprise, because young, small startups use things like header and sidebar.
Right.
And enterprise would do things like, header, rev, 425, revised.
Yes.
And that would become a standard then, and then there would be a Word document that would be checked into source control that you would have to refer to.
Absolutely.
Because no one can understand those.
Actually, if you want to have a great example of stuff like that, go into Word prior to 2013 mm-hmm. and save as HTML. And there's classitis for you right there.
Exactly. You might work for an enterprise if that is a way of attaching semantics where it doesn't really, belong.
Right, exactly.
So in here, you can see we've got things like header and section. If I take section here, by the way, notice that I've just double tapped on section, and I can name it something else.
Oh, overtype, nice.
So we've got overtype on the end there. See here in the corner, it says doctype HTML5. This is nice because that was detected. It actually knows I'm using HTML5. How does it know? Well, I'm in layout right here. It actually calls out at HTML5 doctype.
Right.
But even if I go off into here, you see that? This can figure out whether you're going to detect HTML. In this case here, I've got a different layout that has HTML4, or I can force it to 5. But I can also go into my settings and decide what kind of validation I want.
Like, nice.
When there is no doctype, use HTML5. So here, I'll turn on use doctype. And I can also say show errors and decide how much I want to care. And you'll notice now that index
defaults to HTML5.
Defaults to 5 because it knows that I'm using HTML5 over here.
Awesome.
So our master pages, our layouts all understand that you're doing this kind of stuff, which is pretty sweet. Setting up the responsive design we saw was really, really easy. But one of the things that you want to point out when you're doing HTML5 is that it's not about detecting a browser. You don't want to say, hey, does Opera have that HTML5 thing that everyone's talking about?
Right.
It's more if it has this feature
right.
that I want.
And the terms people might hear is even the IE blog and a lot of HTML design websites, they'll talk about user agent sniffing or client sniffing. This idea that you're going to try and detect what browser you're using or what type of device you're using by looking at the details that they send up in the user agent header, or by looking at sort of APIs in the browser to say, oh, this is IE9 or this is Firefox 7, as opposed to saying, hey, does this browser support this part of CSS3, or does it support the canvas element? Well, right. Let me write some code that figures out whether it supports it by asking it whether it supports it.
Exactly.
And then we have nice libraries to kind of wrap all that up for you so you don't have to do it all the time.
So let's look at the slides to see how we would figure that out. So for example, the canvas element that you
right.
just mentioned. This is a block element that lets you basically draw. It's like paint in the browser.
Yeah, exactly. Bitmap graphics in the browser.
This is the kind of feature that you'd like to know if you had. Now, can I ask IE6, do you have Canvas?
Not via first-class API, because obviously Canvas didn't exist back then. But you can kind of use sleight of hand to say, well, let me try calling this function that represents Canvas, because it is JavaScript after all, mm-hmm. and then just catch the error detail if it doesn't exist, or even inspect the object in which I expect the method to exist. And if it doesn't exist, then I know Canvas isn't there. And I can then pull in a shim, the idea of a library that can add this type of feature on top of a browser that doesn't support it, or perhaps show a message to the user saying, hey, you know, we can't exactly show this right now.
Yeah, exactly. And we ship Modernizer now with ASP.NET, which is a tool that people think makes HTML5 work everywhere.
Right.
Not a good way to think about Modernizer. It doesn't modernize your browser in its strictest sense.
Exactly.
But it does allow you to detect, does this browser have geolocation? Does it have RTC or
audio
whatever.
Audio tag, yeah.
Audio tag, actually. Let's take a look at a slide on that. So some of the other tags that I might care about, like HTML5 video. It gets a little more complicated, though.
Yes.
Because it's one thing to say, does my browser support video? But it's another thing to say, does it support this codec?
Right.
This
Absolutely.
Compressor, decompressor, or that one. What is nice about HTML5 video is because that video is a block element, I can compose it, I can talk about it with CSS, I can target it, I can put things in front of it and behind it. And with these new hardware accelerated browsers, I can spin it around. So I could potentially take a video, apply CSS to it, and maybe rotate.
Yeah.
Make it transparent.
Right. If that's the sort of thing you want to do on your blog, go for it.
Because that would be that would not be garish at all.
At all, in any way.
No, not at all, not in any way. It's really easy, though, to do something like that. It's just a video tag.
Right, absolutely. and I can see you've sort of got some details here talking about this idea of, hey, yeah, it's a video tag, but what if the browser doesn't support the video tag? And I can see here you could embed Flash here. We have a fallback mechanism built into these tags.
Exactly. Let's take a look at the code and see, do I have to remember all of this, and how would I do it? So let's look at the code. If I came back over to my Visual Studio, and because I know that I'm doctype HTML5, so Visual Studio knows we're HTML5, I can type video and then hit tab.
Oh.
And then it expands. So I've got a video snippet. And I can say, you know, Damien, is it E-N?
A-N.
A-N.
Thank you.
And hit enter.
Yeah.
So then it automatically filled all of that out. So then if I have Ogg Vorbis or WebM versions of that I could. And then down here would be, dude, you don't have HTML5.
Oh, I see. So what's going to happen in this case, I guess, is the browser will look at the source. It's going to say, well, I don't support MP4, but hey, I know how to do WebM, so I'll do that on that browser. But another browser might go through, well, I don't even know what the video tag is. I'm just going to keep parsing this document. Oh, a P tag. I know what that does, so I'll run into that.
Yeah, or, you know, you could have, like, you know, Richard Stallman. And, you know, maybe he's running Link. Or links, he would see that.
Right, excellent.
And you just say, hi, RMS. Okay? So this is one of the things that we all learned the very first time we learned HTML5 is that I could go like this, couldn't I?
You could.
And I could say, I like them. What would the browser do with my new I like pants tags?
That's a very good question. That's going to depend on the browser. So a modern browser will see an element it doesn't understand, and just treat it like as a block element. The idea of, well, I have no idea, let's just treat it like a div. So any content inside of it I'm going to render.
Exactly.
But this element has no meaning to me. I don't really know what to do with it, so I'm just going to treat it as if it was a div. If it was an older browser, like IE6, then it had an issue whereby any element it didn't understand, it wouldn't even add it to the DOM. You wouldn't see anything. But things like Modernizer help to fix those type of issues for you.
Exactly. IE6 would basically stick its thumbs in its ears and go, la, 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 I can't hear you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Entire sections of text could disappear.
Just not there.
Exactly. Now, I don't think it's necessarily a best practice, though, to make up tags.
No.
And style them like a div.
No, really not a good idea.
But that is what's happening when the video tag has some fallback. It's effectively kind of an homage to that old way of doing things, which is the, oh, I don't know what that is, then I'll just show that.
Yeah.
So this is probably going to say, you have IE6, right? Visit IE6countdown.com.
Right.
And see how
why that's a bad idea.
Well, see why you're holding back the internet.
Exactly.
And thanks for doing that. Now, if I go in here, even though we are a doctype HTML5, and let me say XHTML, I'm going to lie. So I'm forcing the doctype. Video is gone. Mm. Suddenly, my list of available divs got really, really small.
It's pretty sad, really.
It is sad. Life before HTML5. Go back to HTML5. Now, I've got all sorts of great stuff.
Awesome.
Including things like audio, video, stuff like that. So we want people to understand that Visual Studio knows about this stuff. Web Forms knows about this stuff.
Right.
You can make, can you make nice, clean semantic markup sites in web form?
Absolutely. I mean, and you kind of always have been able to in a way. It always came down to a question of if you were using a server control, obviously it's going to render the markup that it wants to render.
Right.
But you were always free to just put in any tag you wanted, say run at equals server, and then we would have a sort of server representation, HTML generic control we called it, but you could just add properties to it and we'd render them. Mm-hmm. That's still the case today. We did go back in 4.5 and update some of the controls, like the input, like the text box control, mm-hmm. to understand some of the more specific, form-specific details of HTML5. That makes sense in web forms.
Yeah, yeah. Let's switch back over to the slides. So we see audio behaves just like video. You can go and put in your source. And this made it really easy for me, actually, to put up a podcast site.
Right.
It's funny. A couple years ago when I put up my podcast site, I went looking for cool Flash audio players.
Yes.
Today, I go and put an audio tag in, and then I go and look for cool CSS.
To make it look good.
To make it look good.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
So if you go, and what's nice also about that, by the way, is that if you go to Hansel Minutes or This Developer's Life, they all work great on phones. Modern phones with modern browsers uses their HTML5.
That's something we didn't actually mention, is that this whole HTML5 movement, one of the things that really kicked it off was the advent of smartphones. Like 4 or 5 years ago, we had the iPhone came on the scene with this amazingly capable browser, and mm-hmm. it wasn't on the desktop, it was in a phone. And ever since then, every new phone has a really capable browser that can do HTML5 video, HTML5 audio, and even things like Canvas. So mm-hmm. games like Contra Dua can work on an iPad or on a Surface RT or whatever it might be, running a capable browser.
Which, amongst web people, brings up the idea that there's really two operating systems that ship with everything.
Right.
You know, even my phone has two OSs.
Yes.
The one it shipped with, and the one inside the browser.
Absolutely.
Which is a really, really interesting idea. Let's go back to the slides. So, we talked about responsive design in the context of CSS. Your initial question was, would I use JavaScript to look at
that? To do that, right.
But then I said, well, I want to query more about these features. I want to know more.
Yep.
What do I need to do with JavaScript to query those? Well, I can leverage the strength of JavaScript, of things like Modernizer, but also jQuery to kind of explore my environment, explore my DOM. So jQuery is used really effectively everywhere. It is ubiquitous.
It is.
Some people even say that no one writes JavaScript anymore.
They write jQuery.
Yeah.
Well, do you know jQuery?
Yeah, I don't know JavaScript.
I know jQuery, though.
But I know jQuery, exactly. jQuery is really used everywhere, so we've shipped it with Visual Studio for forever. It's easy to learn. The great part, though, is that it has lots of plugins.
Right.
It's super easy to plug in because this $ open parentheses always returns a jQuery object, so its chaining allowed people to plug in different things.
And I mean, jQuery itself isn't a UI framework. It's not like what we used to think of in the past as, I get a bunch of widgets.
Right.
It is an API for easing your interaction with the browser APIs that are there, things like the DOM and AJAX and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it, as you said, because it's JavaScript, people are able to say, well, if you have a jQuery collection of objects, just call my extension method on top of that, mm-hmm. and I'll now make them all do this amazing thing.
Now, what do you say to people who would argue that today's modern browsers don't need that layer of abstraction?
I would say that, yes, they do. So, I mean, there have been improvements into the DOM API over the years, but the DOM API at its core still pretty much looks like it did 6 or 7 years ago. And so if you're going to be doing anything with eventing, if you're going to be doing anything where you want to select a group of DOM elements and then operate on them, the APIs are a little verbose. Mm-hmm. They're not very friendly. They don't allow things like chaining, like you talked to there. And there are still some browser inconsistencies. I mean, sure, if everyone of your website users is using the latest version of Chrome and Firefox and IE, then you could probably standardize on the one set of APIs. But if anyone's using IE8 or even IE9 and you want to do event handling, well, unfortunately, the event handling syntax or APIs are different between those browsers.
Well, not only that is a difference, but HTML5 itself, input type equals date, we'll talk a little bit about later, is something that is in the spec that's not ratified yet,
yes,
and everyone has different support for it.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Let's check out your slides. So there's lots of different things you can learn about with jQuery. There's a very, very rich community. If jQuery is about anything, it's about community.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's plugins, UI widgets. There are things that layer on top of jQuery. And because we like jQuery and we ship jQuery as a supported product, we have jQuery UI on top of that, and then jQuery Mobile.
Yes.
It's kind of a family of jQuery things all building on that core jQuery engine.
It really is an enabler in a lot of ways. I mean, it's a fantastic core library, and then, as you said, there's this amazing community or ecosystem that's built up on top of it over time.
Yeah, absolutely. So the general idea with jQuery is to find something and then do something with it.
Yeah.
Right. So the selector is the most interesting aspect of things, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
The selector engine. And then once you've selected it, are you going to add an engine? Are you going to add an event, rather? Are you going to change some CSS? And it can be a little bit intimidating, but there's some tools we can use to play with this.
Right.
Here's an example where we're just saying $. This isn't a thing yet, but I'm hoping it'll become a thing. When I type $, open, I call it open resig.
Open resig?
Because John Resig
wrote jQuery. Yeah.
And you know, as an homage to him and the very talented team of people, we say open resig, close resig.
Close resig, nice, I like it.
So here we're just hiding a div, and then that div would be hidden. But the problem here, though, is that that's a list of divs.
Yes.
So it's going to, in fact, hide them all.
Hide all of them, yep.
Yep. Here's an example where we're hooking up a click event, and then in line, putting in an anonymous function.
Right.
So that when they click on any input with the class of submit, we're going to pop up an alert.
Got it.
These are real basic. All right. There's something a little bit more complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. So in this case, what we have here is I'm finding all elements that have a CSS class of submit. So there's that selector you talked about. Dot submit is the CSS syntax for...
It's kind of a SQL query syntax.
It is.
But
it's a
domain-specific language
for CSS
selection.
Exactly. So find me elements with a class of submit, and then when their click event is raised, run this function, this anonymous function. And what it's going to do is further find the submit elements again, change their color to, is that red?
It is red.
It is red. And then go off and find an element with an ID of container. So that's the hash container or pound container, depending on what country you're from.
So dot for classes, hashes for IDs.
For IDs. And then I'm going to say to all of the, well, to the one ID container in this case, I'm going to append a block of HTML. So you can see I'm actually using the jQuery constructor, the open resig syntax, to create new HTML on the fly, span of clicked, and then wire up a click handler to that says, go ahead and alert the word foo to the console.
So this is interesting because it shows a lot of chaining, but it also shows a selector inside of a selector.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot going on there in only 4 or 5 lines, and this really shows the sort of expressive power of not only JavaScript, but jQuery.
And that's arguably why it's so successful.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's take a little bit of a look at that. Go ahead and switch over to my machine. So I'm using a website called JSBin, and there's JSBin, there's JSFiddle.
Fiddle, yeah, I'm a big fan of that.
There's CSS Deck. There are other websites that let you kind of mess around.
Right.
They're not IDEs as they are three panes.
They're a playground, really.
It is a playground. So on the left here, we've got some HTML. We bring in jQuery. We've got a div called monkey. It has an ID of monkey, not a class. There's some text in it. And then what are we doing here?
So as we said before, the first thing we're doing is the open resig, or we just call it the jQuery function. And then we're going to pass in our selector. And our selector in this case is find me all the elements with an ID of monkey. So hopefully there's only one on your page, because if there's more than one, that would be a problem. And then after we do that, we're going to make it do some fun stuff. So we're going to call fade out. So this is a built-in function in jQuery to make you do animation. We're going to fade it out. We're going to fade it back in again. And then once that's finished, we're going to go off and append an empty UL element, an unordered list of stuff inside that monkey. And then inside the UL, because that's going to be returned by that append, this is the chaining of the jQuery functions at work here. So append UL will return that UL as a jQuery collection so that I can then further manipulate it.
So then this is self-closing,
yeah,
but this will be inside it.
Correct. So jQuery just lets you do this shorthand syntax to sort of create me a new empty element by making it self-closing like that. So let's append a new element inside of it called clickMe, and then again, that's going to return to you the thing that it appended. So now I'm going to chain a click event handler off that LI.
Off the clickMe.
Off, yeah, absolutely. And this element inside that function will be the raw DOM element that created the click event. Mm-hmm. So I'm wrapping that in a jQuery object so I can use jQuery to manipulate it. I'm going to hide that click element, change its color to green.
While it's hidden.
While it's hidden, and then I'm going to fade it back in again over 1,000 milliseconds.
And I'm going to actually be silly, and I'm going to make it a little bit bigger.
Yes, look at that. Now it's green.
Ship it. So that's just an example of the kind of stuff that you can do.
Absolutely.
Now, if we switch back into Visual Studio and go and make a JavaScript item, just throw one in here. Actually, you know what I can do? I'll even just throw it at the bottom of the page.
Yeah, sure.
Because I can do that. I can go like this, and what's happening here?
So you're getting IntelliSense here.
Right, I'm getting IntelliSense on JavaScript.
Yeah.
With help.
With good-looking help, too.
Very lovely help. And I can go and grab stuff and go like that. And now I'm getting IntelliSense on my events, my properties, all within Visual Studio.
Yep.
There's a lot of editors that do autocomplete.
Yes.
It is important to point out the difference between autocomplete and IntelliSense.
Yes, IntelliSense and statement completion are two things. Statement completion is obviously part of IntelliSense, but the reason it's called IntelliSense is because it knows a lot more about what's going on in your code here. It's actually executing this code. It knows what's coming back.
Right, exactly. If I said something like var a equals Scott and go like this, dot, Scott is a string, so I'm seeing things like index of and length.
Right.
But if I say 5, and go dot.
Yeah, I can see the number functions there, like 2fix and 2exponential now.
But I haven't saved the file.
No, not at all.
So what's going on?
Well, what's happening is Visual Studio is actually recognizing that there is a script block here, and it's projecting into this space the JavaScript runtime. And so anything you type in here, it'll run as JavaScript. And then it can kind of reflect over the code that you've run in memory and then tell you exactly that A is a number. I know, because I just executed the line before it. I can just tell you that.
So let's try to do something kind of crazy and advanced. I'll just make a model. I'll make a model here. Person. And we'll go ID, first, last, birthday. Okay?
Yep.
Lovely. Then I'll go over to controllers, and I'll go and add one. Person controller. We'll pull in person. We'll make a new data context, person context, and I'll hit OK. That's just going to make me some views.
Right.
And it's going to look at person, and it's going to make me text boxes.
Yeah.
Like we saw John do.
They're strings.
So display for, when we look at edit, it's going to say, give me an editor for the first name. Give me an editor for the birthday.
For the birthday.
Okay. So if we go and run that,
Fixing this bug.
What is going on there?
This is the bug in Visual Studio 2012. Let me be completely honest about this.
That let's fix it right now.
On occasion. So what you need to do is go and touch the web.config file. You need to force the site to recompile.
So was I, let me ask you this.
Yep.
And I'm not fishing for compliments. Mm-hmm. Was I going too fast?
Nope, not at all. It is a race condition in the build system when you're using Visual Studio.
Crazy. Good information.
We are fixing it.
Good. So here, first, last, birthday.
Ah, so it doesn't like that.
Well, it knows that it's supposed to be a date.
Right, absolutely.
So I got my unobtrusive validation.
Yep.
And if we do a view source, we can see person. There we go. Input type equals date time.
Date time.
Okay. So it knows it's a date time. Mm-hmm. Input type equals date time. Date time is a new thing.
HTML5. Yep.
But it doesn't look like Chrome 99 knows about that.
No.
Okay. Let me try Firefox.
No difference.
I'm not getting a date picker. Let me try Opera.
Look at that.
So Opera knows about this. So here's a browser that's awesome and is proving it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I'm not getting that elsewhere.
Yeah. And if you're on a mobile device, we talked about some of those native renderers before. Right. A lot of the mobile devices will recognize a date time and show a nice UI for you as well.
So I might want to, if I'm an Opera guy or gal, I want to make sure that I'm using the features of the browser that I have chosen.
Right.
So I don't want to just put in a date picker from jQuery. Mm-hmm. I want to use the native feature if it's there.
Yep.
And if it's not there,
it's fall back
do
to
something else.
Yeah.
So how would I go and do that? I would go and say, make me a little function here that's going to start up when my page is done loading.
Yep.
Okay. So so OpenResig, there's my function. And we're going to say if it's not the case, and then we're going to ask Modernizer, do we support date time?
Right.
If it's not the case, then we're going to go and at this point, I'll drag in the scripts to make sure we have jQuery UI. Mm-hmm. I could go and use a thing like what is it, require.js?
Yep.
Or I could call get script, but I'll say, hey, OpenResig, go get me all the inputs with a type of date time.
So there's another, that's an example of a slightly more complicated CSS selector. Mm-hmm. But that's basically saying, as you said, any input that has an attribute of type where it's equal to date time.
So if you don't support date time,
yep,
make it a date picker. But what am I going to need for that?
Well, you're going to need jQuery UI in this case. We've already got Modernizer. We can see that right there.
Right, there's Modernizer.
But that date picker function that you're calling is actually provided by the jQuery UI library, not by jQuery itself. Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple things that I could do. I could go into the bundler, mm-hmm, and I could change my bundles.
You could.
And get that stuff. Or in for the purposes of the demo.
Scripts folder.
Go into the scripts folder, and we'll grab
jQuery UI.
jQuery UI. jQuery first.
Yeah. Is jQuery not already on
jQuery
the page?
jQuery is probably on the bundles.
Yeah, it might be in the bundle.
Actually, no. Pardon me. You know where it is.
Down the bottom?
Aha! It's right there. Okay?
Yep.
So what I should probably do is go into my bundle config. Okay, so jQuery UI.
There's actually a configured one. We just have to reference
it. It's already there. So I just need to reference that.
Fantastic.
So I'll go here. Take that, then make that UI. Okay?
Done.
Well, then the question will be, do I need any CSS to make it pretty?
Let's find out. Looks like we do.
Looks like we do. So I could, again, add that to a bundle, or for the purposes of what we're doing, I could grab in all,
yep,
which would be cheesy, or I could grab in core and date picker.
Yep.
But let's be cheesy.
Yes. Because we know that'll work.
Exactly. Now, at this point, I'm going to declare tab bankruptcy and close all this stuff.
You need to
those things all got,
yeah,
they all got opened because of my scaffolding.
Much nicer.
So there we go.
Yeah.
But if we look at it on Opera, where's Opera? Hello, Opera. No, I don't want your update.
Yep, still the native
so,
picker.
So, native picker on Opera, not native over here.
Yep.
That's feature
detection.
Detection.
Light up.
Exactly. This is just the beginning of the kind of things that you'd want to do, but this is still just an MVC application.
Yep, absolutely.
In 2012.2, we actually went and shipped a bunch of new stuff for single-page applications.
It's still worth mentioning at this point, too, even though that was MVC, you could, mm-hmm, have done all of that in a web forms application as well. In fact,
touché.
Touché, indeed. Yeah.
This is the beginning of the OneASP.NET vision. At,
yeah,
some point, you're going to expect to be able to pick web API, single-page, web forms, all in the same place, mix and match. Already in 2012.2, as you were going to see, mm-hmm, later this afternoon, mm-hmm, you can take any kind of ASP.NET app and add Signalr.
Yeah, Signalr. Anything,
example,
that's right.
You could take a web forms app and put in web API. You could have a hybrid app, maybe a rich administration site with Telerik controls or something on the back end,
yep,
and then a front end that's modular using jQuery Mobile.
Absolutely.
Totally up to you.
It's all good.
We really want people to understand, and I'm seeing this every day on Twitter, on Facebook, on the social medias, in the forums. I didn't know that I could have a site that was
absolutely
hybrid. You, yep, can. But what we've done here is we've included a single page application, but also from the community applications like Ember.js, not written by us.
No, no, it came from someone else.
So if you want in this dialogue, or the prettier version of this dialogue that will,
that will come
at some point,
yeah,
you can do that. So let's look at a single page application. So a single page application is a little bit different. You could say it has a single page. It's really up to you how you want to do it.
Right, of course.
These kind of Gmail or Outlook.com style apps.
Or even Facebook, for that matter.
Is Facebook a single page app?
It's a series of single pages.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
So like messages is like a section.
Right. So you'll know that if you're on the Facebook timeline, it updates itself. You can do a lot of stuff within that one page, and you don't get a full page navigation. But if you click on something in the main sort of header,
right,
you might navigate at that point.
So if we run this app, our little single page application, out of the box, we're going to get a little to-do list. Notice the URL isn't changing.
Right.
You see? I'm adding lists, deleting lists, renaming stuff. The URL hasn't changed. Now, if we go and look at that in some browser tools, put that over here. I'm going to hit F12, put the browser tools over there. Where am I go? I lost my browser. Ah, there we go. Take a look at the network, okay? I just said add list.
Right.
That's calling a web API that we're going to talk about in the next segment.
Right.
So we just said post, that means create a to-do list.
So this is really taking the AJAX phenomenon, turning it up to 11.
Exactly. Here we just deleted it. Notice that that wasn't a get.
It was actually an actual delete method.
If I add some stuff, buy pants. See? Post.
That's a bummer.
Double click on it. Let's look at the body. We just sent a little chunk of JSON over there to buy pants. That got caught on the back end. We'll learn more about that in the next segment, but what I want to show you is if we look at the page itself. So this is the HTML. This happens to be using Knockout.js. It's a JavaScript library for doing model view, view model.
Right.
Now, we talked about model view controller and that idea of separation of concerns. You can have model view controller on the client side if you want, mm-hmm. meaning that all inside your browser, you can have a model and a view and a controller, mm-hmm. something like Ember.js or Angular, or something like Knockout, you can have kind of a model view, view model.
Yeah, and we kind of tend to associate model view, view model systems with UI frameworks that have state. So we talked before about how the browser is now basically becoming a fully functional operating system. It has capabilities. Well, you'll see the model like MVVM or model view, view model used in Silverlight or WPF, these rich UI frameworks that have data binding and stateful sort of memory.
Right, exactly. In here now, we've got a number of new features built into 2012.2. including IntelliSense for Knockout.
Oh, fantastic.
Inside of here, which is pretty slick. And I've added in Web Essentials. And when you're doing a lot of client-side work on a system like this, you're going to need more than just type ahead. You're going to need really great JavaScript IntelliSense, but also the ability to explore these sites like we saw with with Page Inspector, mm-hmm. but also some really cool improvements that we made to the CSS editor.
Right.
So this is the CSS for our to-do list. Notice that lines 9 and 10 have this grayed out vendor-specific prefix.
And they faded a little bit there.
Right. Mozilla's box shadow is different than WebKit's box shadow.
Right.
I can actually hover over them, and you can see which version of the browser that's available on.
Right.
So here I've picked box shadow, but I can see that that will only work on a specific version of Safari and above. So I might want to make a decision then based on that. While the WebKit one only works, of course, on WebKit browsers. That's a feature that is added in Web Essentials.
Right.
You can download that at VS Web Essentials. And maybe that's a feature that will move down
into
VS itself,
right,
which is pretty freaking amazing. We've also got, like we saw before, IntelliSense. I could say something like background clip, hit tab. That expanded into these. But notice how box shadow is is the boss. It's the bold one.
Right.
I could start changing things.
Synchronized typing again.
Right. I'm getting synchronized typing. We talked a little bit earlier about the idea that less is a way to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. So let's think about the problem. There's repetition. There's nothing I can do about that, right? Well, there's repetition in CSS. You can either fix it with tooling,
yep.
write straight CSS, or write it in a domain-specific language, like
less. Higher-level language.
Higher-level language,
right.
that then compiles into it.
Correct.
So this is, again, this idea that you guys have choices.
Yep. We're right? not going to tell you how to do it. We're going to give you great tooling so that you can do it either way. It's up to you.
Exactly. Now, on this one here, I've got color. FFC, so it looks like it's kind of a cream.
Yeah.
Control-J. These are the colors that are in the document. This isn't a generic color palette.
This has always been a really horrible problem with CSS, too, like
right.
remembering what my colors were.
So here are the colors that we are using, but I can pull this down.
Any color under the sun.
Pick any color I want, okay? Or I can zoom in on this little Legend of Zelda sword in the corner here, and then pick one of the rich palette of colors that Visual Studio has made available to me. Up here, any of these, this gray, or maybe this gray here, possibly any of these grays.
It is a very nice gray.
It's a lovely gray. Yeah. Apparently, it's EF, EF, F2.
Oh, the 2 is important.
It is true. I'm going to pick the green that's right there.
Beautiful.
And I'm picking it off of our browser launcher. Notice this browser launcher here. You pull that down. We've got a number of different browsers. This is new. I've plugged in Electric Plum. This is a third party that has an iPad, an iPhone simulator. And the new in 2012.2, more emulators. You can click on that. You'll go up to the ASP.NET website, and you can download other emulators.
Oh, wow.
Because when you're writing a single-page app or anything that's complicated in HTML5, you're going to want to test that.
Yeah,
make sure it works everywhere.
Of course.
Including BrowserStack.
Oh, I love BrowserStack. Big fan of BrowserStack.
It's ridiculous,
yeah.
isn't it? So if I run BrowserStack, it's actually going to pop up a thing and say, well, what kind of machine do you want?
Right.
Well, I want an Android that's a Samsung, or I want a Windows XP machine running Firefox 13. And then you can go off there and have fun. BrowserStack, everyone gets a free, I think it's 3 months.
3 months, yep.
Yeah.
Courtesy of the IE team, I believe.
Yeah, they're awesome. All of our friends over there. What's my password? Apparently that's my password. So if I want to take a look at something, I don't even know. What does my browser look like on a Razer?
Let's find out.
It'll go off into the cloud, fire up that server, and then for debugging, if you want, and your IT department allows you, you can set up a tunnel. Basically, tunnel from localhost wherever you're doing your work mm-hmm. over to BrowserStack.
So I can actually have that phone browse to localhost on my machine. And,
right. So you see, I'm actually kind of remoted into this.
Right, into OS whatever it is.
OS whatever running a Razer. So opening your URL.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? So it's kind of ridiculous because in this case here, I'm on like in Flash doing whatever. So we'll see if my blog, I've never seen my blog so on it.
You're in a browser using Flash, remoting into a VM, running an emulator.
Right. So I'm in a browser with HTML5, running Flash, using VNC.
VNC.
And there's my blog using responsive design.
Of course.
Thank you very much. On an incredibly slow phone from the late 90s. I don't know when this, apparently this one has a low battery as well. So that's integrated into Visual Studio now if you want. You
that's
can
fantastic.
Go up to asp.net/browsers, check that out, which is pretty fabulous. We've got all sorts of features, and I'm going to be sprinkling features about Web Essentials throughout. I mean, there's so many things. I could literally do an hour just on stuff like Control Shift Up Down. You know about that?
So that's like adjusting the hue. Is that,
yeah.
is that what it is?
Is it hue or?
Oh, well, the lightness.
Lightness.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's unbearable. The lightness.
Something.
It's an unbearable lightness. So yeah, there's so much stuff that we could talk about. And then what we're going to do is we're going to take a break. We'll come back and we'll learn about the Web API. In this case, my single-page application was making AJAX calls that we saw in our browser tools, talking to an ASP.NET Web API. We're going to dig into that with John
cool.
After our break. Thanks, you guys.
Cheers.